The House Finance Committee meeting to order. Today is Monday, May 13, 2019, and the time is 9 o'clock a.m. With us today is Representative Merrick, Representative Josephson, Representative Sullivan Leonard, Representative Knopf, Representative Lebon, Representative Tilton, Representative Carpenter, Vice Chair Johnston, Co-Chair Foster, and I'm Co-Chair Wilson. Today we have SB 43, Extend the Big Board Game Outfitter Licensing before us, and the Chair would entertain a motion. Representative Johnston.
Madam Co-Chair, I move the committee adopt CSSB 4331-LS0442/S as the working document.
Hearing no objection, I'll have Ms. Gaddis please come to the table and explain to us the changes in the CS.
Good morning. My name is Lynn Gaddis, staff to Co-Chair Wilson. So the House CS for Senate Bill 43, Finance, version S, as it compares to Senate Bill 43, version M. And we're ready. The committee substitute changes the title to an act extending the termination date of the Board of Barbers and Hairdressers, extending the termination date of the Big Game Commercial Services Board relating to a person's eligibility to hold a registered guide outfitter license, master guide outfitter license, class A assistant guide license, or transporter license, and providing for an effective date. And if you'll go to page 1, lines 8 and 9, it amends to read Board of Barbers and Hairdressers under AS08.13.010 changes the sunset date from June 30th, 2019 to June 30th, 2024. That completes the only changes that the committee substitute does to Senate Bill 43, version M, which you previously heard in committee.
Thank you. Representative Tilton.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I believe that it reads 2027 on line 8.
You are correct. So, yes, on line 8, it changes it from on 9, 2019 to 2027. Thank you, Representative Tilton. Any other questions or comments? Representative Josephson.
Just a question for, I guess, the sponsor.
Why don't you ask the question, we'll figure out who needs to answer it.
Through the chair, I'm just curious about section 4. It essentially says, don't violate the law or you could lose your license. And I assume, and maybe Mr. Stacey knows something about this as well, that that was true in some respect before.
So the next step is we're going to bring the sponsor up to explain the bill. We just want to make sure everybody understood the change. I want to just comment on the change. I want to thank the sponsor of this bill for allowing us to make this change. It was brought to my attention a couple of days ago that the Barber and Hairdresser Board was about to expire in June. For whatever reason, there was not a piece of legislation, even though they, from my understanding, had a clean audit, which we will hear from the auditor. And I didn't think we wanted to punish a board for having a very good record and being able to clean their act up. So it was nice to have a nice little vehicle to carry its water with them, and without Senator Wilson's approval, that would not have been able to happen. So with that, Senator Wilson, would you like to please come to the table and explain your portion of the bill, and then we will have Chris Curtis come and talk about both boards before we go to public testimony. Welcome back.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair and Finance Committee. For the record, I'm David Wilson, Senator for District D. Senate Bill 43, and just talking about the Big Game Board extensions, as I told Ms. Curtis, you never get attached to a piece of legislation, just like similar to you never get attached to a character in Game of Thrones. Senate Bill 43 extends now also the Board of Hairdressers and Barbers, but the Big Game Commercial Services Board until 30/24, which is one year less than what Ledge Audit had the 6-year recommendation that was changed in Senate Finance. The board consists of 2 registered licensed guide outfitters, 2 licensed transporters, 2 private landholders, 2 public members, and 1 member of the Board of Game. Ledge Audit conducted the review and made 3 recommendations for improvement of this board. Please note that all 3 recommendations are in purview of the division, not the board. Again, these are all in the purview of the division and not the board. The audit finding recommendations. The first one was Division of Corporations Business Professional Licensing. Director should improve the management oversight procedures to ensure the documentation is obtained and reviewed and to retain license support to licensure. That the division's chief investigator should increase oversight to improve the timeliness of investigations. Multiple agencies are now involved, and it's the time to extends are very complex. For example, from a time a guy may be found guilty or caught violating by, let's say, a fish and wildlife trooper, it could take up to 2 to 3 years for that case to go through full adjudication. At that time point, they have open investigations, and that costs a length of time, and that's why they have so many open investigations, because it takes a very long time to go through the full adjudication of this, and most folks consider these licenses as property rights, so we are very cautious of when to take someone's property rights away from them in the state. The Office of the Governor, the third recommendation here was the Office of the Governor, Boards and Commissioner Directors should work with the board to identify potential applicants and work with them in a timely manner. It was recognized that more supervisory support was needed to provide more quality control. The department has worked on adding more supervisors and additional examiner, and they work to improving more training and to work on improving training and procedures. The new chief investigator and the two new senior investigators were added to provide more quality assurance, and they have heard from the message from legislative audit, and they are working to hold more investigators accountable to their paperwork and making sure that they are timely checking throughout the length of the investigations, however long they may be. I will note that they've had, they have lowered sort of the open cases, and I believe in the time in March, they only had 56 cases. I think in April, that's lowered. Again, I just don't have that email with me here, but also, as mentioned, we have Director Chambers from the division to answer questions, and Ms. Curtis is also here, and they can talk about their wonderful duties related to this board. And with that, thank you, Madam Chair, and I'm open for any questions. Oh, and I guess I should, through the chair, answer the question for Mr. Rep. Josephson. The change there was about the master guides, the functions, and the master guide license is a guy license that is more of an honorary title, and we're just stating if you act as a bad actor or have a fine during that time, you lose that honorary title. In no way, shape, or form does someone else does not have that title, does not impact their ability to earn income. They still have their license. They just lose, if they, if they regain their license or other sanctions, they just lose that honorary title. And we just want to make sure that that title goes to sort of the best of the best of the guides if you're going to have call yourself a master guide.
Any questions or concerns for Senator Wilson?
Yes, actually.
Representative Josephson.
Through the chair, under concerns, it's a very competitive time for all of us in terms of our ability to read all that comes to us, Madam Co-Chair. But there are a lot of criticisms of the board not enforcing violations of hunting laws, and I'm concerned about it. I don't know if the senator wants to talk about that.
Senator Wilson.
Through the chair, and I think this is something that Director Chambers can also go through as well, and talking about a lot of it was the lack of investigators that was in the department during this time period. They had some timeliness issues with the investigations, and part of that, I'm trying to see if I can have the original. They lost 3 to 4 in the past few years of that time frame that led to the sort of the backlog. Like I said, their backlog has been sort of dwindled down drastically now, and they only have a few, I think it's in the 30s, I believe, 39 or so cases that are now currently open. But like I said, there was 50 in March, and so they're working toward that, and they're working through the time frames of how long it really takes these cases to be adjudicated. That was on the record in Senate Resources upon the timeliness of the investigations, and they went through a sort of a case scenario of how long it took from the time that person was first contacted by state troopers until the time that case was gone through the adjudication process and finally went to the disposition stage. And at that point, then that sort of the board feels a little bit more qualified to start going through that without the additional lawsuits and the appeal processes and be able to sort of put someone's license on hold. So I think that was a change in this bill. was to allow and to give a little bit more teeth for the board, that saying that they can suspend a license of violations after someone reviewing or renewing that license, and that was in the section two, original section two of the bill, to allow them to have a little bit more teeth, if you will, to help address some of those issues and how long it takes to sort of revoke someone's license. Now this also gives them the ability to suspend license for violations that have already qualified for that as well.
Thank you.
And have you or your office done any research? One of the issues has been investigations, the cost, and if someone's found guilty, they don't pay those costs. It goes on the licensing, and that's one reason where if people look on page 10, they got over $1 million into debt, and I know most of that was because of lawsuits that were brought that should have been brought forward. And there's been a lot of talk in this building about the possibility of changing it to where if you're being investigated and you get taken to court, that you pay some of those court costs, and it's not just brought on to the good players to have to pay those. Have you done any kind of research to see whether that would be advantageous to this board versus continually raising their fees because they're trying to do the right thing?
We have not. I was hoping that Mr. Henry might be on the phone here, but I don't see. He may not have arrived yet to testify.
And it may be something that the committee might want to take on at some point. Basically, what happens is that they have all these investigations. If you're found guilty, let's say you were guiding and you didn't have a guiding license. So you take whatever penalties is, but all the costs it took to take you to court, you know, to do the investigation, all goes back to the board, and those who are actually carrying licenses pay those costs. And, you know, at some point, that becomes a pretty big lift because you can only – there's going to be a point where people can't pay whatever that fee is. It doesn't come out to where the business is profitable. So we've talked about it a lot in this body, but nothing has really, you know, ever been done because it's kind of tricky on how you do it. But I think we're getting to a point where we should quit punishing those who do have licensing, paying for those who don't have a license or aren't doing the correct thing. But that's not in this bill. It's just I know that this particular board was in a lot of trouble, almost got dissolved because of that at one point, and it literally was just going into debt. So, Representative Josephson.
Madam Chair, on the point you've just raised, when I was, I think, a freshman legislator on legislative budget and audit, I made exactly that point or a variation of it, and that is at some point the board is bearing an expense that should be borne by the Alaska people. How to do that, I don't know. But for example, if there's an enforcement and it's expensive and it's no fault of the general membership, then if you care about the law, the people need to participate in enforcing it. And I don't know how to make that happen.
And the right person paying for it. So with that, we're going to bring Ms. Senator Wilson.
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. And I found the email from the April board meeting. There are 37 open cases as of April, and 13 of those cases are the Alaska Wildlife cases that the board nor the division have any control over. And 10 are some level of litigation through the Office of Administrative Hearings, and 2 are in the hands of the respondents able to accept or reject those positions, and the remaining 12 are seven are the breach of contracts of complainant issues or licenses application process, and one is for a guide interference issue.
Thank you. Cases open. And with that, we'll bring Ms. Curtis up, and we'll do these individually. And so we'll start with the Sunset Review of the Department of Commerce, Community, and Economic Development, Big Game Commercial Services Board. Ms. Curtis.
For the record, my name is Chris Curtis. I'm your state legislative auditor. So you should have a copy of the audit in your meeting packets. It's dated September of 2018. This audit concluded that the board is serving the public's interest by conducting meetings in accordance with applicable laws, by amending regulations to improve the occupations under its purview, and by supporting changes made by the Department of Law to improve the timeliness of the investigatory process. Additionally, the board eliminated the over $1 million deficit that we reported in the 2015 Sunset audit. However, our audit also concluded that board licenses were not consistently supported by adequate documentation. We did find a high number of investigations with unjustified periods of inactivity, and 3 board positions were vacant for an extended periods. So we recommended a 6-year extension. In the audit, there are the standard information, On page 8, you'll see the schedule of licensing activity. It shows as of May 2018, there were a total of 1,219 active licenses. This represents a 20% decrease when compared to the 2015 sunset audit. According to the board chair, the decrease is due in part to a reduced interest in the profession and guides retiring. Additionally, the chair reported that there were less transporters because many changed operating as air taxis to avoid the licensed transporter reporting requirements and fees. So for some perspective on that point, as of April 2015, there were 151 licensed transporters. And as of May 2018, there were 90 licensed transporters, which is a decrease of 40%. The board schedule of revenues and expenditures is on page 10. The board did have a surplus of just over $132,000 at the end of FY18, and this is significant because they did have a deficit of over $1 million at the end of FY15. We do have three recommendations for improvements. They begin on page 14, recommendation number one. We recommend the DCBPL director improve management procedures to ensure required documentation is obtained, reviewed, and retained to support licensure. So we did test 25 new licenses. We found errors in 14 of them. You can see the errors listed on page 14. The more serious errors were missing background checks and a lack of investigatory review. According to DCBPL management, there were turnover in the staff that provided support to the board, which contributed to the errors. The audit also noted a lack of adequate supervisory review. Recommendation number two, on page 15, we recommend DCBPL chief investigator increase oversight to improve the timeliness of the investigations. We did test 22 investigations that had been open for over 180 days during the audit period, and we found unjustified periods of inactivity in 20 of the 22 cases. According to the chief investigator, the periods of inactivity were due in part to a lack of adequate resources to investigate the high caseload and supervisors not adequately monitoring their cases. Recommendation number three is on page 16. We recommend Office of the Governor, Boards and Commission staff work with the board to identify potential applicants in a timely manner. From July of 2015 through May of 2018, there was a licensed transporter board position and a private landholder board position that were vacant for 6 months due to the inability to identify interested applicants. And there was a Board of Game board member that was vacant for over 8 months because Office of the Governor, Boards and Commission staff were not notified of the vacancy. Responses to the audit begin on page 25. Commissioner of Commerce, Community and Economic Development agrees with recommendations number one and two and has stated that the department has taken steps to resolve both recommendations. Senator Wilson did go through some of those changes. Office of the Governor responded to recommendation number three on page 27. They do agree to work to fill the vacancies in a timely manner. And then the chair of the Big Game Commercial Services Board response is on page 29. The chair agrees to work with the Office of the Governor to identify interested applicants, and he did state that all of the board seats were filled at the time of his response.
And I have one question. On the air taxis instead of a transporter, is that a definition issue with our statute? I guess I don't understand how they were able to qualify themselves as a transporter and then as a taxi. Maybe that's a commerce question.
Yes, that is a I don't know. I did hear testimony during this bill when it last time that was going to possibly be the case when it was being extended last time. I think everyone knew that could happen.
Okay. And we'll ask that to the department. Representative Knopp.
Madam Chair, so... in response to your question, there's Big Game Commercial Services Board is charged with licensing transporters, but there is an exemption in the transporter license for air carriers. And there's three rules on that says if it's subsidiary, if it's not the primary nature, you don't advertise, charge a premium. And I'm trying to think. There's three exemptions for air carriers to be transporters, but the air carriers, one of the reasons you see the deductions. I addressed this last year with transporters and people in the airline business who were primary transporters had to be licensed as transporters, but now they're all Part 135 operators who so transport and hunters is secondary to the primary purpose of their business, no longer to require to have that transporter license to do the same thing. So that's why you see a lot of them reductions in the airlines. We tried to address the transporter licenses with water taxis last year and run into opposition from the board on that issue. And then recently I've received a letter from the board that stated they wouldn't oppose my bill if they could make the decisions on who would become a licensed water transporter. Currently, that same exemption does not apply to people in the marine business. So reality is the Alaska Marine Highway System should not be transporting hunters because there is no exemption in place for them to do so. I've had people in the industry who had to turn long-term customers away to somebody else who carried a transporter license, and they could no longer transport them if they were carrying archery, even equipment, hunting equipment, you know. So anyway, it's a long story in regards to your question, but I'd like to know from the chair, are you planning on moving this bill at this meeting or taking amendments to it, or what's the plan of the chair in this bill?
Yeah, Representative Knopf, we do not move a bill the same day. We give everybody an opportunity to be able to do amendments, so we will have it back before us tomorrow. So if anyone has any concerns, we'll be taking amendments tomorrow morning. Representative Josephson.
Through the chair, Ms. Curtis, I'm an admirer of your work for sure, but I find the recommendation here, and I'm, you know, I confess some of this is a bit of a cursory review, but it's pretty generous. I mean, for example, page 14, 7 license files are missing. They're just not there. And one, maybe some of the 7 have outdated background checks required by law. I mean, I know they've done well in terms of paying down the indebtedness part, and perhaps that's what your office was thinking most. I don't know if you want to respond to that.
Through the chair, Representative Josephson, it is an inexact science, for sure. We just did an audit of this board 3 years prior, which we concluded they were serving the public's interest at that point as well, except they had a $1 million deficit. So we did keep that in mind when we came in 3 years later, that they continued to be serving the public's interest, and all of these recommendations are really on the shoulders of the division. And that played a really heavy part as well, that the board had made improvements to deal with the deficit. They were still serving the public's interest, and the problems we found were mainly at the division. But we didn't extend them 8 years. We did recognize that and reduce them 2 years.
Any other questions on this board? Seeing none, we're going to move to the sunset on the Board of Barbers and Hairdressers.
For the record again, Chris Curtis, Legislative Auditor. So this audit is dated April of 2018. We did conclude this board is serving the public's interest by effectively licensing and regulating the various occupations under the board's purview, and there are quite a few. The board monitored licensees and worked to ensure that only qualified individuals practiced in Alaska. We are recommending an 8-year extension for this board. So if you turn to page 6, you're going to see the schedule of licensing activity and all of the occupations that this board regulates. Barbers, body piercing, estheticians, hairdressers, instructors, manicurists, tattooing and permanent cosmetic coloring, school owners, shop owners, and student instructors. So quite a few occupations. They had 5,534 active licenses at the end of January of 2018. We noted that this is just a slight increase compared to the 2010 sunset audit, so not a huge amount of growth in these occupations. Schedule of revenues and expenditures is on page 7. They did have a significant surplus at the as of March 2018, just over $840,000. According to DCBPL management, they were going to be doing a fee analysis in FY19 to look at changing those fees. The schedule of fees is shown on page 8. We make no recommendations as part of this audit.
Any questions? Seeing none, thank you very much, Ms. Curtis. Okay, and then we'll have Commerce next. Welcome, Ms. Chambers.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, Sarah Chambers, Director of the Division of Corporations, Business and Professional Licensing. There are several questions that were raised that I'd be happy to address.
Please do.
Thank you. One is that, as Ms. Curtis has mentioned, for the Big Game Commercial Services Board, all of the findings that are in the board audit are actually administration concerns. There were no findings that were any fault of the board. They were directed at our division to tighten up our licensing procedures and our investigative documentation, and then to the governor's office to make sure that vacancies are filled. The audit is now more than a year old, and I can assure you that we have put different policies and procedures, as well as requested more resources to address the concerns raised in this audit, and quite frankly, in other audits that the legislature has done on our licensing programs. Because, as the chair has pointed out, all expenses are borne by the licensees. We try to keep a very lean operation, but that means that we have almost no redundancy. So when we have turnover, when we have a vacancy in an examiner position, there is only one licensing examiner for the board, Big Game Commercial Services Board, and there are only two for the Board of Barbers and Hairdressers. So when we have a vacancy, that means that a supervisor who has many boards under that person has to pick it up and then train a new individual. So we have gone back and done our own audit as a result of this audit and found some errors that were just due to lack of resources, lack of oversight. And so that's been amended. We've hired additional records and licensing supervisors and continue to redistribute the responsibilities to make sure that we can provide adequate quality control. The investigative findings were simply a matter of needing to document when something is open for a long period of time. In the documents for this bill, there's one individual who has raised some concerns about the board's ability to do its job and how it's doing its job. And this is a private person's opinion. It's not based in fact, and it certainly is not based in the audit. So we have put new policies and procedures into place to make sure that all programs investigators are documenting any vacant or any lack of activity for 30 days or greater. That means that when something's over at law, or something's with the troopers, or waiting on a respondent or a board review, you can look in, or the auditor can look into the documentation and see that, and that's what was missing in this audit. So I want to be very clear that even though the legislative audit criteria says that we are auditing the board, the division has a great deal of responsibility in what's actually being audited. And all of these errors are firmly on our division shoulders, and that we've taken responsibility for that and put things into place to make sure that that doesn't happen in the future.
So again, as far as the air taxis and the transporters, is that a statute fix if we want to make sure that who we think belongs underneath either one of those, or could they the entire time have been qualified underneath either one of these?
Madam Chair, my understanding is that the exemptions that Representative Knopp was mentioning regarding transporters deal with essentially marketing and position of a transporter. If picking up hunters is ancillary to the primary responsibility of the transporter, and if they are not specifically marketing to this industry, then they're not required, and I'm generalizing, they're not required to have a transporter license, and so many are opting not to do that, and they're changing their marketing slightly. That is in statute, so if there needs to be a change to that, or if it's the will of the legislature to change that, that's where that would need to happen.
And also on investigations, I know a gentleman that they reached back 9 years on an investigation that was closed and then reopened it for administrative purposes. Nothing new had happened. So is there no accountability for the investigators? I mean, at some point you should know that it's over and it's done, But it sounds like here that the board could go back as far as they want to and decide when an issue is closed and when it's not. And we can't even do those in our court, so it seems very strange that we could do it within a board purview.
Madam Chair, I'm don't believe I'm familiar with the investigation that you're speaking of, but I know that our standards are based in the law and that no board or investigator should be going back and arbitrarily reviewing and opening up cases that have been determined to be closed without a triggering event.
I don't know whether it was reopened. I think it was just continued. I guess that's where my question is that to no fault of the individual, is there not a point in time where maybe you didn't get the letter to say it was closed so that it could keep coming back? There's not a statute of limitation when it comes to boards going back in time and revisiting a case?
Madam Chair, that what you're describing shouldn't be happening, and so perhaps I could speak with your staff and find out more about the specifics of that particular case.
That's pretty concerning. Representative Knopp.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So, Ms. Chambers, so in that same line, my question really is who, so when the board does investigation, just based on a complaint, I would assume, typically we're a new applicant. So I guess I'm wondering, and so I heard a story, and I don't know if it's true or factual or not, but went back a year, maybe two, where a guide was charged with a DUI, and the board decided that because of that action, that his business practices should be investigated somehow related. Now, I don't know if that's fact or fiction. So, but the question is, if something like that was to be a charge like that or an accusation like that was brought forward, who would decide whether that warranted an investigation? You or the board? I mean, the department or the board, not you specifically, but the department or the board? Who makes them decisions? Because we know investigative cost is what drives their cost.
Thank you. Through the chair, Representative Knopp, that's a great question. We don't have the resources to go out and seek out situations, so we are complaint-driven, as you mentioned, and our complaints come in from, could be a member of the public, could be a client, could be another another guide, and with this program, many of the investigations are triggered through trooper action, where they've discovered something out in the field, and we have a great system and partnership to maximize that their skills and our skills and try not to be redundant and wasteful among the two. When a complaint comes in, our staff does a review, and if we need assistance in determining whether it's jurisdictional, whether it falls within the section of statute or regulation that's pertaining to this board, then we'll pull a board member in and have the board member assist in going over that. If it is something that appears to be a potential violation, then it progresses to an investigation. Sometimes items are not, they're frustrated competitors, and it's not a jurisdictional issue. Sometimes the board member says, look, this, in the case of a an aged violation that just came to light, this board is a leader in reviewing what have we done in the past, reviewing what is really pertinent to the public safety concerns as opposed to the letter of the law, perhaps. For example, a DUI, is it relevant to someone's guiding, or is it something that is completely irrelevant and would be a waste of resources to pursue?
Thank you. And that you just exactly what I would didn't reluctant to say, but the gentleman that told me about this called it a witch hunt. And so that's what was the purpose of my question to you. Would we pursue an accusation like that if it didn't directly relate to what their profession was? And that's kind of where I was wondering who was making these decisions, and are we spending a lot of excess resources trying to investigate these when they're not truly relevant to the business practice, so.
And through the chair, we really minimize. I mean, we have to ask questions. So if someone gets a call and says, "Hi, I'm with, I'm the investigator with the board," and someone's filed a complaint, we have a duty to ask questions and find that out. A respondent might feel like it's a witch hunt, but we're doing our job, And then if it turns out that it's irrelevant, if it's not statutory, if it's not jurisdictional, then we'll drop it. But we do have to ask the questions, and I think sometimes people may not take kindly to being asked those questions and respond accordingly.
Representative Josephson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. When, just so I'm clear about this, when the auditor reports that there were seven files looked for and they weren't there, who's the curator, who's the keeper of those files? Is you don't house the files for the Board of Optometry and the Board of Architects, Surveyors, and Engineers, do you? I mean, so you physically have the files?
Through the chair, yes. We are the administrative arm for all of our boards.
Follow up. So they have a meeting, and they're looking at documents just the way we are, and they somehow bring those documents to you or scan them to you?
Through the chair, Representative Josephson, board members are volunteers who convene to make governing decisions about the program. We maintain, we accept, we receipt, we file, we scan, and then we put all of the documents that pertain to the board. Someone mails in a license application, for example, it comes to us, and then we're the repository for that. We do provide documentation to the board, such as a license file, if they are responsible for reviewing it. Some boards aren't, and they get that through a software program, but it's always in our custody. We are the legal custodians of those files.
Just follow up. So just to be clear on this, and it's pretty clear at this point, when Ms. Curtis is talking about auditing files, she's physically, or her staff are going to your office?
Yes.
Okay. Madam Co-Chair, I may have been a little bit heavy-handed in my previous comments about the board. I want to make sure that if there are bad actors in the hunting community, that they are vigorously followed and that rules are enforced. That's my main concern. I want people to hunt by the rules. And to the extent I overstated it earlier, I appreciate that Ms. Chambers is bearing the burden, as she said, and indicating that this is their responsibility. Thank you.
Representative Carpenter.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Is there a requirement for licensed individuals to self-report violations? Is that currently on the books?
Through the chair, Representative Carpenter, I don't believe there's a requirement for that for this particular profession, but we do encourage self-reporting, and we do find that many guides, just as Representative Josephson mentioned, they want to be responsible, they want to do the right thing, and when something occurs, whether it's, sublegal sheep, for example, they haven't, they've misjudged, and they've ended up taking an animal that's not legal, we will, I don't have a percentage, but almost always a responsible guide will call that in and will report that and will deal with the consequences. But there isn't a mandate, for example, if someone doesn't self-report, there's no penalty for that. There would be a penalty for the actual violation.
And we also have Major Chastain from Alaska Wildlife Troopers. Would you like him to weigh in on this, Representative Carpenter?
Sure.
Major Chastain, can you please put yourself on the record, and could you help Representative Carpenter with his question?
Good morning, Madam Chair. Can you hear me okay?
I can.
Yes. Morning, House Finance Committee. My name is Bernard Chastain. I'm the Deputy Director for the Alaska Wildlife Troopers. Could you please repeat the question?
Representative Carpenter.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I am curious about the self-reporting requirements for a licensed individual who has a violation. Is it a requirement for them to self-report the violation?
Through the chair, Representative Carpenter. So I will direct you to Alaska Statute 0854720, number 1A1, and that specifically addresses violations of a licensee. And what that states in brief is that it's unlawful for a licensee to report or to not report within 20 days a violation of state or federal wildlife or game guiding or transportation services statutes or regulations that the person reasonably believes was committed by a client or an employee of the person. So what that means is that if the licensee has a client that commits a violation, that licensee is required to report it. Or if that licensee has an employee of the licensee, they have to report it, but they're not required to self-incriminate.
Thank you.
Representative Ortiz.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. Chambers, you spoke about earlier about how a lot of your agency's responses are based on complaints that come in. You spoke about, I think, while I'm very much aware that DCEED is one of the largest, one of the most significantly cut agencies over the last 4 years. Are you at the point now where, because of the reductions in staff and the reductions in funding for your agency, where it's becoming highly difficult for you to meet your obligations and your monitoring obligations and all the different your permitting obligations and all those kinds of things? Is it becoming very problematic to fulfill your duties at this point?
Through the Chair, Representative Ortiz, we're very fortunate in our division to not have been cut in any with any personnel because we're fully self-funded, fully funded by receipts. We've been a little bit protected, I think, from some of the general fund related personnel reductions. However, as I mentioned, we are growing. People want to be licensed. People want to come to Alaska and work in licensed professions. More and more professions are seeking licensure, particularly healthcare professions. So our staffing has not kept up with the increase in the volume and the complexity, and quite honestly, Americans' demand for immediate gratification and to be licensed before they even submit an application. So it's a thing. So we have worked with each administration to analyze and make modest increases, but they are not keeping up with the demand. So it's a delicate balance to try to keep licensing fees low. As Representative Wilson astutely mentioned earlier, we have for years been analyzing and working on potential solutions to reduce licensing fees by asking the Alaska public to share in the cost of licensure. There is a opportunity for any program, but particularly complex programs like big game commercial services, medical licensure, to have very expensive appeals of board decisions, whether they're license denials, whether they're discipline, and it's not unheard of for individual cases to go into the hundreds of thousands of dollars. All licensees have to pay for this, and so that's been a concern of ours. Representative Keto last year introduced a bill that would make an attempt to cure that, but it didn't get any traction, so that's something that we would be interested in as well, just again in the realm of no pun intended, but resource management.
Representative Knopp.
And then I'll quit beating this horse. Ms. Chambers, did we not last year move to consolidate all investigative services for the boards under public safety? Didn't we try to band all these together? Were we successful in that attempt? And if we were, does it take away from the department's timeliness for investigations or control of costs or anything like that? But I don't recall what happened to that, but I remember we had that conversation.
Through the chair, Representative Knopp, the only recent consolidation attempt is the governor's current administrative order that is going to be studied this coming fiscal year, where all investigative services in the state will be consolidated under the Department of Law. So that we're at the very beginning of looking at how that might affect all of the areas that you just mentioned.
But the boards can also determine if they so choose to have an investigator actually for their board. I mean, some of those, as you just mentioned, have more investigations. That would still be an option for the board themselves since they're the ones who are paying.
Madam Chair, investigation, that's a nuanced answer. The investigation is statutorily under the purview of the department. There are a few boards that have gotten investigators in statute for themselves, but they don't operate any differently than any other investigator in our department. So
Probably not.
Okay. I just remember that we have put some in there, but I didn't know what kind of meaning it had with them. So if there's no other questions for Ms. Chambers, we're going to go to public testimony. Seeing none, thank you very much for being with us today. I am going to open public testimony on SB 43. And first we have Mr. Virgil Umfenauer. Are you on the line? If you could please.
Yes, Madam Chair. Can you hear me?
I can. If you could please put yourself on the record and your affiliation, you may begin your testimony.
Thank you. My name is Virgil Umfenauer. I live in North Pole, Alaska. I'm a master guide. My son is a master guide. I've been involved in the regulatory and management process of our fish and game resources for more than 30 years. I've been on the Yukon River panel, part of the Pacific Salmon Treaty since 1988. I've served three terms on the Board of Fish, 16 years on the Fairbanks Fish and Game Advisory Committee, 8 years as chair. In the early 1990s, the board expired. The department licensed some people with marginal qualifications. After the board was reformed, the department and the investigators were overzealous, and they conducted many frivolous investigations. The department ignores the Administrative Procedures Act. They violated the intent of the regulation pertaining how a complaint is investigated. The department actually has denied guides from petitioning the board or the department under the Administrative Procedures Act to clarify the regulations or the intent of the regulations. The board is the only defense that the public, the guides, and the transporters have against overzealous investigators and managers in the department that do not understand what guides do for a living. And so I am fully in support of keeping the board. As I said, I spent 3 years on the Board of Fisheries. I'm very familiar with the Administrative Procedures Act and the right to petition, which is the right that every citizen of our country has because of the First Amendment to the United States Constitution that's in the Administrative Procedures Act. The Department of Commerce does not follow, or in my case, did not follow the Administrative Procedures Act and allow me to petition the board to clarify a regulation mandated by the legislature. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Umfenauer. Always good to hear from you. Hope things are going well back home. So next we're going to go to, I have Kevin McKinley on the line. Mr. McKinley, are you just here for questions or did you want to testify?
Good morning, Madam Chair. For the record, my name is Kevin McKinley, and I was just here for questions, Madam Chair.
Thank you. And he is here with the Barber and Hairdresser Board. I want to thank Mr. McKinley for bringing it to our attention that they were about to sunset, so we were able to take care of it. Thank you, Mr. McKinley. I see no questions. If you could just hold every once in a while, we'll get curious. So with that, we're going to go to Wayne Kubat. If you could please identify yourself,
Chair,
and your affiliation.
Finance Committee. I'm Wayne Kubat. I've lived in Alaska permanently since 1976 and have been guiding since 1981. Thank you for letting me speak today. I would also like to thank Senator Wilson for sponsoring this bill. I have listened to every hearing and have read most of the documents associated with SB 43. The Big Game Commercial Services Board provides a valuable service to the public and to the guide industry. Unfortunately, there has been some negative public testimony that was misleading and inaccurate, much of which has since been proven so by the Department of Commerce and other state agencies. Almost all of the negative comments are coming from a new organization and their members who seem to mostly dismiss and disregard the major accomplishments that the board has recently achieved. Several bad actors have lost their licenses, several have been censored, and $1 million debt has been paid off. No board is perfect, but this one has been doing a pretty darn good job, and the recent audit mostly confirmed that. SB 43 has strong support from a broad sector of the Alaskan public and from the Alaska Department of Fish and Game and the Board of Game. Most of the major hunting and conservation groups in Alaska, including Alaska Safari Club, Alaska Wild Sheep Foundation, the Alaska Outdoor Council, and many others have also expressed their support. The board is a very important piece of the puzzle towards promoting a healthy relationship and balance between public and commercial interests in the responsible stewardship of Alaska's wildlife resource and towards maintaining the long-term viability of the guide industry. Extending the board for only 2 or 3 years would be an extreme waste of time, effort, and resources for everyone. Letting it sunset would be a big negative for a majority of Alaskans. That happened once before, and it wasn't a good time. I respectfully urge all of you to support and pass SB 43 in its current form with a 5-year reauthorization. Thank you very much.
Thank you for being with us today. Next is Mark Richards. If you could please put yourself on the record and your affiliation.
Good morning, Madam Chair and members of the Finance Committee. My name is Mark Richards. I'm the Executive Director of Resident Hunters of Alaska, and I'm representing our 2,000 members from across the state in strong opposition to Senate Bill 43, extending the Big Game Commercial Services Board for more than 2 years. Since coming out of a 10-year sunset in 2005, this board has been audited every 3 years, and no extension since reinstatement has gone more than 3 years. There is one salient overriding fact that has prevented this board from receiving anything near a full year extension since coming out of sunset. It wasn't just the board's debt, but the continued high number of complaints and violations and the backlog of investigative cases and timeliness of investigations that is in every single audit report. From the 2018 audit report Ms. Curtis mentioned, I quote, the audit concluded Division of Corporations, Businesses, and Professional Licensing needs to improve its ability to investigate cases timely. A review of the board investigative activity found 233 cases were open between July 2015 and May 2018, and 80 remained open as of May 2018. During this time, there were 145 cases open for over 180 days. Of the 445 cases, auditors reviewed a random sample of 22 cases and found 20 cases had unjustified periods of inactivity ranging from 2 to 18 months, unquote. Also note that this same audit states that, quote, the prior recommendation from the 2015 audit to improve timeliness of investigations was not resolved. This same fact is in all the other previous audits since 2005. Regarding the board's debt issue, the way it's being resolved, and this is something I don't think the committee understands, is by moving to consent agreements for guides with violations instead of costly administrative law court. So now it's typical for a meeting, such as one this past winter, that I was, that it was a teleconference that I listened to review and vote on 17 consent agreements with violations ranging from wanton waste of game, not applying for a guide use area, guiding outside one's guide use area, herding grizzlies with snow machine toward clients to shoot. And each one of these type of meetings result in guides getting off with minimal fines and probation. And you know, one example of this is at that meeting, the guides discussed one of the guys that didn't apply for his guide use area. He took six hunters out without being certified that fall. And the guys on the board said, oh, I know this guy. I've known him for a long time. He's been around. He just forgot to get his license. Well, that's like saying you forgot to apply for your driver's license before you drive. It's the first thing a guide should do. The fact is this board cannot afford to operate in the public's best interest, whereby guides with multiple violations are actually weeded out of the industry. So while the board has reined in its debt, keep in mind how they're accomplishing that. Again, every sunset audit of this board has expressed the same concerns, and the process has not been streamlined. Nothing has been changed. Think of it this way. If the board were a business that was audited every 3 years, as this board has been, for performance, and every single audit expressed the same exact major problem, well, first off, that's just not good business practice. Secondly, without repercussions, there is no incentive to change. That's why we only support a 2-year extension of this board. Show us they can fix the problem the last audit and all the other previous audits addressed before receiving a longer or full extension. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Richards. Is there anyone else online that would like to testify today? Is there anyone else in the room who would like to testify on SB 43? Seeing none, we are going to close public testimony on SB 43. Any further questions or discussion on SB 43? Seeing none, it is my intention to bring this bill back before us in the morning. If there are any amendments that you'd like to see, please get them to my office as soon as you can. Thank you very much. That is all we have on our agenda today. I am going to recess the call of the chair. Since we do not know how long floor session will take or any other bills that may come before us, but currently next will be SB 44, Telehealth, Physician Assistance and Drugs, HB 139, Alaska Permanent Fund Corporation Procurement Exemption. Hopefully we'll have someone here from the Department Administration or someone else who could talk to us a little bit about the differences of procurement and why this, again, is so important to have in this bill, and SB 16, Alcohol License, Fairs, Theaters, Concert, and Bonds. Is there anything else? Seeing none, I'm going to recess to the call of the chair at 9:55 a.m. I'd like to call the House Finance Committee meeting to order. Today is Monday, May 13, 2019, and the time is 2:30 p.m. Today with us is Representative Merrick, Representative Josephson, Representative Sullivan Leonard, Representative Knopp, Representative LeBond, Representative Tilton, Vice Chair Johnston. I'm Representative Wilson. We have two bills before us at this moment. We will be recessing this meeting as we are still waiting for the committee substitute for SB 16 to come from legal. But to keep you entertained, we are going to start with SB 44, the telehealth physician assistance in drugs. Representative Johnston.
Madam Co-Chair, I move the committee adopt CSSB 4431-LS0019/O as the working document.
Hearing see no objections, the working document is before us. And we have Ms. Carpenter, Heather, to first of all go over the changes we heard a little bit about previously and then also the fiscal note with that change. You can please put yourself on the record. You may begin.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, my name is Heather Carpenter, healthcare policy advisor in the Department of Health and Social Services. The department worked with the sponsor for a couple of changes. These changes can be found on page 1, lines 2 and 3. It expands the title to include relating to prescription drugs under the medical assistance program. The next change can be found on page 3, line 14, through page 5, line 4. It adds a new section 5 that amends AS 4705-012 to include the Medicaid preferred drug list and prior authorization medication list to material incorporated by reference via regulation. What that means, because it seems a little wonky, is that the list can be adopted after each time our pharmacy and therapeutics and drug utilization review committee meetings occur every September, November, January, and April. Changes will be publicly noticed, stating the new list replaces the old list. This can happen in about 60 days, versus right now we can only update the list once a year because it takes 6 to 9 months, and if we updated it multiple times a year, we would have competing regulation packages out there. This is very common for lists, codes, manuals, or certain guidelines that are updated periodically. Some examples include the federal poverty guidelines for the state, the current procedural terminology for physicians published by the American Medical Association, and the Consumer Price Index. The next change can be found on page 4, lines 5 through 13. This is the policy that requires, it's a new section 6 that amends AS 4707065 to require the Department of Health and Social Services to capture cost savings and cost containment for prescribed drugs by adopting and updating the preferred drug list and prior authorization medication list. It gives a definition for those lists and lists specific types of cost savings and cost containment measures for the pharmacy program that can be utilized. And Madam Chair, the final change is on page 5, line 20. It applies the immediate effective date to sections 5 through 7.
Any questions? Seeing none, if you could please go over the fiscal note with us.
Absolutely. The department introduced a draft fiscal note to this CS. It reflects $1 million of savings for this next FY20 and savings of $2 million a year for FY2021 through 2025. You'll see that these savings for FY20 are listed as included as part of the governor's proposed budget. Just a reminder, his proposed Medicaid GF reduction was $225 million. So this tool would absolutely help us meet that. However, I'd like to clarify, this was not part of our savings the department put forward as phase one Medicaid savings. So this number would not have been included in the budget numbers that both the House and the Senate put forward that went to the conference committee. It would be additional savings on top of that.
We don't have it, Madam Chair.
Okay, we're gonna take a brief at ease. Back on the record, and everyone now has the fiscal note. Before we get to that, I see that we have Ms. Costello here for SB 16. I just want to reiterate, we'll be doing SB 16 in a little bit. We're still waiting for the committee substitute, so she's more than they are more than willing to listen into our other conversation, but we will not be taking that up at this time. So we are now on the fiscal note that everybody has on SB 44. Any more questions on the fiscal note? Seeing none, are there any other questions or concerns about SB 44? Seeing none, what's the will of the committee?
Madam Co-Chair, I move CSSB 4431-LS0019-O from committee with individual recommendations and forthcoming fiscal notes.
Seeing and hearing no objection, SB 44 has passed from committee. Moving on to HB 139, Alaska Permanent Fund Corporation Procurement Exemption. One of the questions that we had from our last meeting was to better understand the procurement process. And so we have the Department Administration here to speak to us on that. If you please come forward, please put yourself on the record, and we will have Representative Carpenter reiterate his question. Thank you so much.
For the record, my name is Linda Polk. I'm the contracting manager for the Department of Administrations. And I did receive a list of questions that I was asked to come here and give answer to.
Well, if you would like to start with that list, we will. And then they have others.
That works for me. Okay, so the first question that I had received was, when was the procurement code passed? So AS 3630 became effective in January 1st of 1988. And it's based on the American Bar Association's Model Procurement Code. Their code was adopted by the House of Delegates of ABA in 1979, and it was resulting in from some extensive work from their committees. One note about the ABA code is it is one of the most successful projects ever conducted by the ABA regarding this. The other question is, has it been updated since its passage? And so I wasn't sure if that was regarding the ABA or AS 3630, so I picked an answer for both of them. So the ABA code was revised between 1997 and 2000 with input from the National Institute of Government Purchasing, which is NIGP, and the National Association of State Procurement Officials, also known as NASPO, assisted with the update of the ABA. After the update of the ABA, then AS 3630 was updated. SB 12 allowed us the modernization of our Alaska code, and that came in effect on June 26, 2013. Some of the changes on that code was it allowed us to start accepting electronic bids or proposals, because when the code was first put into place, this was back in 79 before emails or faxes existed, so we did update our code to meet the changes. We also updated our code to add change in small procurement threshold. This was to raise the threshold of small procurement because cost of things were starting to go up, and it would just help speed things up. This code was also changed for the Alaska business license requirements. It used to be that in order for a vendor to offer a proposal, they had to have an Alaska business license at that time, regardless whether they're Alaska business or not. That was delaying some vendors from being able to get in, and it was reducing competition. So with SB 12, we were able to change it, and now they only have to have their business license at time of award. So it allows them to participate much easier. We also, our bidders' preferences were consolidated and simplified with that. So the third question, and I think might be the big one here, is why does procurement take so long? We hear that a lot from our customers as well. So really, in answer in short, small procurement, which is $100,000 or less, can take a matter of days, or it can take a few weeks. But the formal procurement, that can take 3 to 6 months and sometimes longer. It really depends on what you're procuring. Most of the time that's involved for the formal procurement is one of the things under the code is that it's required to be posted to the online public notices system for 21 days. And this is really to allow sufficient time for circulation, time to maximize competition. The thing with this 21 days, though, is a procurement officer can reduce that if it's a need, if there's a need for the project. I currently have one right now that I put out there only for 2 weeks. So if there's a need, you can reduce that time. But the reason for the length of time, too, is also to allow time for protests. So that's really to help ensure fairness. The vendor community polices themselves, and that gives them the opportunity to come forward to let us know if there's a problem. During this time, it also takes time to evaluate the bids. It takes time to conduct negotiations. So all of that happens between that 3 to 6 month period. The other question is, what are the benefits of the procurement code? It's increased consistency across agencies. It's helpful to the vendor community to know what to expect. Equal treatment of our vendor community, fairness. Alaska bidder's preference. The code has, in our Alaska code, we have the Alaska bidder's preference, which gives in-state vendors a leg up, a better opportunity to be able to win the bids and try to keep the money in-state. Having the code, it allows for transparency, competition, and allows us to really get the best value for the best price. The last question I had was, what benefit of the procurement code that would be missed if APFC was granted this exception? It would really depend on what the type of procurement it is. You know, I understand that they, if they're doing things that are financial related, there are things that need to be exempt. There are, I believe, over 50 exemptions, and there's a reason for it. But I'm only going to testify on basically what would fall under ours, our DOA procurement, and what would be missed without that code in effect. So again, you would have no competition. You would have single source awards without justification. There would be no transparency. Protests would not be allowed. Alaska preferences would not apply. And you may not get the best value for price, but you will also lose public trust. So that's to the five questions that I had received.
Brooks and Carpenter, do you have further questions?
No, that pretty much sums it up.
Go ahead, Representative Carpenter.
Sorry, I did have
it wasn't you.
So follow up just about the 1988 procurement code and the improvements that have been made, or the additions that have been made. I assume they're improvements. Has there been a review of the whole process? And I know this doesn't really have anything to do with what we're doing right now, just wholesale. Have we went from start to finish and looked at the entire process for improvement, or is it just as we've recognized something as needs to be addressed, we've addressed it?
Through the chair, Representative Carpenter, the code that's through the American Bar Association is constantly reviewed. That's through, we have several different, like we have the National Associative Procurement Officials, we have NIGP, which is the Institute of Government Purchasing. There's these public procurement entities that watch the code, that review the code, they give recommendations to the change in the code. There hasn't been a lot that have come forward. I mean, this code that was developed and that was adopted by, the last I looked in 2000, it was 16 states that adopted this code. And so I don't know if Alaska itself is constantly reviewing it. I know us internally we do, and we're actually looking to do a reg change right now on a small procurement code. But so if you're asking, do we directly review the code, I would have to say no. But is the ABA code, the main code that we've adopted, reviewed? Yes.
Follow up? Thank you. The minimum 21-day waiverable, I said my word's waiverable, not yours, but that's just what I wrote down. That 21 days, is that done for procurement of people or services?
Through the chair, Representative Carpenter, the 21 days is waivable, and it's based on the procurement itself. It depends on, is there a need that we have to get this procurement in place immediately? So we can use that as a justification to shorten it. Or do we realize that there's not a whole lot of competition and there's no reason to have it out there that long because we're sure that there's only a few vendors that are going to participate. So there could be a lot of different reasons as to why we reduce that time.
Final follow-up.
Follow-up.
So the Permafund Corporation has said that they need to get down to like within a 10-day window of being able to hire somebody. Is it possible for our procurement code, as currently written and managed, to get down to a 10-day window for them without a waiver of some sort or an exemption?
Through Madam Chair, Representative Carpenter, there is another little piece, though, to think about. Not only you have that 21 days posting, but if you're doing a solicitation, there's also the time to design the scope of work. So you have to do that before you post it out online. So there's pre-work that has to be done that is part of that 3 to 6 months on a normal solicitation. So they would be required to do that pre-work and then have it out there for 10 days. Although, and this is only an assumption, I would assume that there would be some pre-work prior to them going out and doing a purchasing regardless.
Okay. Thank you.
Representative Knopp.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Like Representative Carper, I'm just going to fire off a series of questions here. But
well, let's do one at a time so that she
I will do that. So I'm just trying to be clear because I come from local government, which is just a little bit different. But so the formal bid process versus the small procurement process would be basically the advertising period and the dollar amount with the less than 100,000 for small procurement. I imagine for a formal bid process, 100,000 and above would be required. Is that fair to say?
Yes, Madam Chair, Representative Knopp. So with the small procurement, you actually have three different levels in the small procurement. If it's $0 to $10,000 currently, that's reasonable and adequate, and you can just go buy it. If it's above $10,000 to $50,000, you do have to get at least three quotes. Of those quotes, a magazine could count as a quote. You can look at a magazine or an online, and that counts as a quote. From above $50,000 to $100,000, you do have to get those quotes in writing. But there's no time frame. You can put those quotes in writing, and you can email it out to your three. They have to be three Alaskans, and you can tell them you want your price back tomorrow, and you can do that.
Follow up. So that would go. That's what we call the informal bid process in local government. It's kind of along the same lines, different boundaries. But so 100,000 is a number it takes to trigger the formal bid process at the state level.
Madam Chair, it's over 100,000. So
over 100,000. Okay. So in sole source contracts, in local government, a sole source contract that exceeded the limit of the formal bid process, it had to come back to the governing body, whether it be council or assembly, for approval at that. Does the state have anything like that in place? And I'm going to just tag on to that question. That, in a sense, is not necessarily what this exemption is asking for. Is it sole source type exemption, or is it going to follow more of the informal bid process, excluding the dollar amount?
Madam Chair, Representative, it's so that we do have the sole source procurement award process. If you're in a small procurement, then that just has to be signed off and approved by your commissioner. If it's a formal procurement that's a sole source, it has to be signed off by your commissioner, and it also have to be signed off by the chief procurement officer. But I think that's a little outside of what APFC is asking for, is the ability to, if they don't have to follow the code, then they would have the right to just go directly to somebody when they felt they needed to.
And it wouldn't even require follow-up, Madam Chair. It would not even require the procurement officer's signature then at that point.
Madam Chair, that would be my understanding. If you're exempt from procurement, all of the requirements under AS 3630, if you're exempt from that, then you don't have to follow any of those rules.
One more.
Absolutely. We need to understand this. Go
so, Would the procurement officer can he actually deny a sole source contract at that level then, if he finds it excessive or maybe should have followed a different process? Does he have that authority to reject?
Through the chair, currently in our code, if the procurement officer takes issue with what's being presented to them, they definitely would push back to their customer and say, I don't feel that this is a sole source and I'm not willing to bring it any farther.
Okay, thank you.
Representative Josephson.
Thank you. Through the chair, you've described pretty well the flexibility within the current law, and I just, if you could repeat the items to the extent you can recall them where the statute allows some flexibility. I think you said the minimum release time can be adjusted somewhat. Can you go over that again?
Madam Chair, Josephson, yes, so our code requires you to have it out on what we call the online public notices, or OPN, for 21 days. If you have justification that the 21 days is not going to work for that particular procurement. The procurement officer has to put a note in writing into the procurement file stating that they found that there was a need to shorten that amount of time, and they just have to describe the reason why. And once they have that, then they can shorten it as short as they need to still be able to get a decent proposals.
Okay.
If you put something out there very technical, you couldn't shorten it to 5 days and expect to get a proposal.
Follow up? So we were given a list of the schedule, essentially, and there are a number of other items, reference checks, protest period, the RFP itself. What else can be adjusted?
Adam Chair, Representative Josephs. There's quite a few things that you can really adjust. Again, you have that 21 days that are set there. It depends on how quickly you can get your scope of work built. Mm-hmm. That you're going to put out there to tell the vendors what it is that you're trying to procure. If you have a good enough team and they know what they want, that can go pretty quickly. After the solicitation closes, yes, there is that 10-day protest period. There is not a way to shorten that.
Mm-hmm.
After the protest period, then while the protest period is going on, you have what you call the proposal evaluation committee. They're the ones that are looking at the proposal. They're weighting the proposal. They're evaluating the proposal. If the committee is pretty quick, they should be able to get done and turn it around in a matter of days. There are sometimes when you have a committee that they're very busy and they're tied up and they can't get to it, and so sometimes it can take them a couple weeks. But it really depends on your committee and their ability to be on top of the procurement that you're doing.
Okay. Thank you.
Representative Johnston.
Yes, thank you, through the chair. I'm not quite sure if this is an unfair question, but you've gone through a number of scenarios where this can take longer than what you would hope it to. And first of all, an RFP that's way far more technical than what you have there in procurement to address. But secondly, just after the 10-day review period, you say that sort of depends on how busy everybody is. Do you currently have backlogs? Or is there any way of getting a value around?
Madam Chair, Representative Johnston, I do not. When we do our solicitations, we definitely get our committees on board. We let them know ahead of time exactly when we think that the proposals will be coming in, when it will be closing, and we tell them that they need to either be able to dedicate that period of time or to please not be on the committee and put somebody else on the committee. So you can definitely control your proposal evaluation committee. If you have a proposal that you have plenty of time and it doesn't matter, then you can allow them that flexibility. But as most of the solicitations that I do, I don't have that type of time to allow that. And so I tell them when and where, and if they're unable to, then I ask them to remove themselves from the committee.
Follow up? But I thought I heard you say to Representative Josephson there are times sometimes when there is an issue of the committee being really busy, and so it's sometimes they can't be as Johnny on the spot as everybody would like.
Madam Chairman and Rep. Johnson, those are just examples of what could cause a procurement to take a long time. But again, the procurement officer is in control of the procurement. If it is one that has to be rushed, then you're just not going to allow that. If it is one that you have plenty of time, then that is something that could end up drawing it out longer is your committee's schedule.
Okay, thank you.
So if I understand you correctly, so first of all, the investment management contracts, those are exempt currently. Is that correct?
That's correct, yes.
And if I understand your testimony today, too, is that there is a process right now that doesn't always take 54 days, and that if it's something that the department or the permit fund corporation would say, we need to have this in short time, what I understand, the 10 days is not necessarily an issue going through the process we currently have.
Yes, Madam Chair, that is correct. We have had solicitations that because of a need that we've needed to have a vendor on board within 10 days, and we've had them on board in 10 days.
Right, and I appreciate that. So then to get to the protest portion, which is kind of where I'm having issues right now with, could you tell me how often someone protests a procurement and if possible, how many times you find it necessary to go back out because maybe it got changed and it wasn't notified correctly, or basically the person was correct and it made a change.
Madam Chair, that actually, so when we put a solicitation out, we actually refer to it as a draft RFP. And a lot of times it's feedback from the vendors that causes us to amend them and to change them. After an RFP closes, and if we do receive protests, they do happen. Sometimes it can definitely draw out a procurement to take much more time than you had planned on.
And when someone protests, do they normally wait till I maybe don't know the statistics, but would they happen like within the first couple of days, or is it usually 8 or 9 days before they do? Do you normally know how long someone will wait to file a protest?
Madam Chair, actually during the 21 solicitation process, they have the ability to protest the solicitation itself up to 10 days before it closes. So if there's problems with the solicitation, they've already are addressing that and bringing it to your attention. Then you're able to fix it while the solicitation is alive and out there. The protest that comes after the solicitation closes, that's when they're going to possibly protest. They don't feel like that the other person should have won. And that's really all that comes out after that period.
And so I heard around the table a little bit about that this would be sole sourcing. I guess I don't understand if we're still having the process, we're lowering it from 54 days to 10 days, that's an accurate statement unless I'm missing something.
So any type of any type of award is protestable. So if you do a single source award, you still have the 10-day protest period. So if you went in and you immediately did a sole source award, you still wait the 10 days, and then you can go into contract.
Okay. Representative, do you have a question? Representative Carpenter?
Something doesn't exactly fit. If I'm looking at getting a process started and finished in 10 days, but then I've got a 10-day protest period, does that protest period start on day one and the process is continuing, or is it we get to the end of the process and then you've got another 10 days?
Through the chair, Representative Carpenter. I'm sorry, I think I wasn't clear. I know we were talking about sole source and we were talking about RFP. So in order to get somebody on board, if you wanted them on board within 10 days, that would be a sole source award and the protest period, and then you sign the contract. To do an RFP, to do an actual solicitation, then you can put it out there for 10 days, 5 days, but as soon as that has closed and you picked your person, you do have your 10-day protest period following that.
Follow up? Thank you,
thank
you for the clarification. The sole source, how long does that process look like if it's a separate from the RFP process?
Madam Chair, Representative Carpenter, the sole source process is, it really depends on how quickly you're able to get your justification as to whether or not this is the sole source. You document it, you put in your proof that this is the sole source, and if it's a small procurement, it goes to your commissioner and it can be signed that day. If it is a formal, then it's going to go to your commissioner and then to the chief procurement officer. When they hit our shop, the chief procurement officer shop, we usually turn around on the same day.
So let's just, I have $1 million investment, and I have to go to procurement to have engineering over the things that we've heard beforehand. I'm assuming somebody from the Permit Fund Corporation brings it to your shop, as you just said. And if I'm understanding correctly, that if they come and say, you know, we have this very small window of opportunity, we need to get this in and out as quickly as we can, you're saying that you believe that you could do that within the same 10 days that this is saying, am I understanding that correctly?
So are we talking about a sole source or are we talking about an RFP?
Just to go through the procurement
just
process.
Just to go through the procurement process.
Let me clarify. So obviously, so this bill is talking about procurement, correct? Mm-hmm. And so to go down from 54 days to 10 days is going through the procurement process and narrowing down the amount of time, and what we had heard the other day was because one of two things, if and we've got the sponsor of the bill, so if I'm incorrect, please let me know, that there, one of two things is that they needed to go from 54 days to 10 because they could lose the opportunity to be able to make that investment, or they have to basically go through a third party, which costs us more money to do because they have to give, I guess, once the investment is sold, 20% of that profit goes to this third party. So we don't want to do that if we don't have to, which I think there's probably nobody on this committee that if there was a way we didn't have to give someone else 20%, we're in favor as long as we're still, we have an open process. So I still have this $1 million project. I have to go, because it's over $100,000, so I have to go through the process. All I'm trying to figure out, because what I'm hearing you say is that although it says 54 days, it can go within that 10 days. Is that accurate?
So, Madam Chairman, so if you're doing a solicitation and you can shorten it from being on the OPN for 10 days, that does not finalize the whole process. You have to build the scope of work. You can post it out there for a shortened period of time because of written determination. But even after you finally picked your vendor, you still have 10 days of the protest period. So if you're doing a solicitation, a formal solicitation, I do not believe that you could get one start to finish, award, pass the protest period, and everything that's required within 10 days.
Okay, well, this bill doesn't call for the protest period. So kind of setting that, that's a kind of a entire situation of its own. But just the process, well, I would assume that they would already be doing all that beginning work so that they knew exactly what they wanted, you know, how they're going to put it out there, because they would still have to do that pre-work even if we were to change this from 54 days to 10, correct?
That is correct. In fact, if they did all their pre-work, they could even put it out there for 5 days if they felt that they could get enough bids in that shorter time.
So really, the from my opinion only, and I'll let Representative Johnston, because I'm not trying to sabotage your bill, is that really what we're talking about in this really is the 10-day appeal portion of it, because with this bill, there would not be an appeal.
Correct.
Representative Johnston, do I have most of that correct? And if not, what part do I not?
I think you've got it pretty correct. I think the other stumbling block could be, besides just the appeal, is the process, as was brought up earlier, a highly technical sole source could also cause some delay. So I think the 10 days would be,
So on the sole sourcing, trying to keep it divided into two different issues, so if I do a lot of business like this, which I think the Permanent Fund Corporation does. I mean, they buy a lot of real estate, and I'm sure they've had dealing with all sorts of good individuals and bad individuals when it comes to that. So on a sole sourcing, how does that work compared to procurement?
So, Madam Chair, on the sole sourcing, what they would need to do is put together justification as to why it's a sole source, why it needs to go directly to this vendor. And then for a formal, again, it would go to their commissioner to be signed, and then it would come to us. We look at the justification, we see that it meets the single source or sole source, and those are usually turned around in our office on the same day.
And question to Representative Johnston, to what extent does this bill have to do with sole sourcing, since we're just talking about going from the 54 days down to 10? Where would that fall within this bill, or is that something that's already they're already able to do? And we can call Ms. Rodell if you would prefer.
Yes, I would like a lifeline.
So if Ms. Rodell could please come up, put herself on the record, and if you, ma'am, could stay, because I'm sure we're probably not done with the discussion yet. And I'm trying not to simplify this down too far, but for me, I need to, because I don't want to confuse the two issues of what we're trying to do. So I think we understand, Ms. Rodell, when it comes to the procurement issue and the 54 and the 10, could you please help us understand the sole sourcing portion of that and whether or not this – well, first of all, does this bill have anything to do with changing how you're able to do a sole source contract now?
For the record, my name is Angela Rodell. I'm the Chief Executive Officer of the Alaska Permanent Fund Corporation. What this bill would do is that for investment-related services only, any sole source contract related to investment-related services would no longer need to go to the commissioner or to general services or whatever they're called these days, General Services, for approval prior to making that award.
And that is correct.
Thank you. Appreciate that. Representative Josephson.
Through the chair, and I apologize to the two of you for this rather fundamental question, but when we use the term sole source, do we mean that the person contracting with the vendor wants a sole source? That is, I just have that vendor in mind. Or do we mean that the contracting party must make an argument that they are the only one on the planet that can do that this thing?
Through the chair, my understanding, Representative Josephson, is it's the latter. We have to, when we ask for the, when we prepare the justification, we have to explain why the recipient or the vendor being contracted with is in a position and should be awarded that contract solely without an RFP process, and make that justification to a commissioner and to General Services, to the Chief Procurement Officer, to both of them. And if either one of them disagrees with our assessment of that, we then have to go through the formal procurement process because we do not have the exemption today.
Follow up. So even under this bill, the exemption that you would receive as the 51st exemption under the statute wouldn't give you carte blanche. You still have to make a sole source kind of argument?
Through the chair, Representative Josephson, we would document why we were selecting and hiring because we are still subject to legislative audit. Our books and records are subject to that audit. We do annual audits. So this is, it's important to note that this is for a limited set of things that we procure at APFC. This is not for a full procurement exemption, and that the justifications still have to be done. It's just no longer going to the Chief Procurement Officer and the Commissioner of Revenue for approval.
And one last question for me. Ms. Poole, you were talking about the transparency issue. What makes it less transparent for the public?
Madam Chair, if you're exempt from the procurement code, it doesn't have to be posted publicly. The solicitation doesn't have to be posted publicly. There's no requirement that any of the vendor pool know that there's a need or that there's a solicitation.
Thank you. Representative Johnston.
Yes, thanks. Thank you, through the chair. Do you know currently if the ARM board or even the investment arm of the Department of Revenue has to go through procurement for these services?
Madam Chair, Representative Johnston, I do not.
Ms. Verdell, do you know?
Through the chair, Representative Johnston, the Alaska Retirement Management Board is exempt
from all procurement, right? Thank
you. And that was a yes from Ms. Verdell. Representative Carpenter.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. Verdell, question for you concerning the public notification of procurement individual that you want to work with. Would there potentially be an issue of you telegraphing what it is that you're looking into publicly that would impact your ability to get the result that you're looking for if that was public knowledge?
Through the chair, Representative Carpenter, it could prove difficult to enter into the investment itself if people become aware that the investment is available and we're seeking third-party advice and the investment may move away from us because sometimes these things are done in a highly confidential manner. If you think about it from a merger, an acquisition standpoint, or an initial public offering standpoint, most times these aren't public. They don't want them to be known that the investment opportunity is public, and they don't want to telegraph that. So if we're telegraphing with a notice that we need expertise advice on a particular investment, it could jeopardize our ability to enter into that investment.
Thank you.
Any further questions or discussion? Representative Ortiz.
Madam Chair, Ms. Rodell, in the last time you were before this committee on HB 139, help me remember, did you testify that with this type of investment makes up about, I think you said, well, go ahead and tell me, how much of our portfolio is is tied, currently tied to this type of investment? I think you
Through the chair, Representative Ortiz, approximately 12% of the portfolio.
And follow-up?
Follow-up.
And was it your testimony that of that 12%, we earned like a 30% return on that type of investment?
Through the chair, we did a year ago, last year, FY18.
Follow-up? And so under the current requirements that you're in, the current procurement requirements that you're under, you're able to earn 30%. So by going to HB 139, is it your goal to mainly we're going to benefit by saving on the fees associated with that 30%? Or what's the big benefit of I mean, that's a pretty good return on your investment under the current status. So what do we gain by adopting HB 139?
Through the chair, Representative Ortiz, I think what's important is that when we look to the requirements being placed on the Alaska Permanent Fund and the debate that's happening and the need to continue to have good returns on the Permanent Fund, that we do as staff, that we do all the things we can to both lower the costs associated with making those investments as well as making sure we have the biggest funnel of investment opportunities available to us. Over time, historically, we've seen windows open and windows close on investment opportunities. And so we want to make sure that not only can we make the best possible investments, but that we keep the funnel as big as possible and see as many investments as possible, especially given the need to have a well-performing fund.
Representative Laban.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Maybe as a follow-up to that line of thought, have we lost some investment opportunities due to the timeline involved here as it currently exists?
Through the chair, there have been times where we have chosen not to pursue. When we feel very strong, let me put this more in a positive standpoint, is that when we feel very strongly about what we're seeing initially on an investment, that is when we've chosen to sort of use an alternative route in order to make sure we get into it. If we've chosen to bypass an investment due to the timeline, it's not necessarily due to the fact that the investment is bad. It's just not generating enough excitement on the front end to warrant going through an alternative process.
Follow-up. Globally speaking, or maybe at least nationally speaking, Alaska, I like to think, is unique. We have an Alaska Permanent Fund. How many other states have a like permanent fund? Probably not very many, pretty safe to say.
Through the chair, Representative Laban, actually, there's probably about 10 states now in the United States. And in the last 10 years, we've seen an increase from 30 countries having sovereign wealth funds to over 90 countries having sovereign wealth funds. So there is a recognition that saving a non-renewable asset and creating a financial asset with that provides tremendous benefits to the population.
Follow-up. Looking at those 10 states and their investment decision-making process, do we have a feel for whether Alaska is at an advantage or disadvantage in competing with those other 10 states for these investment opportunities?
Through the chair, I think to your point, Representative Laban, we do have an advantage because we're one of the older, more established funds, and we're the largest of the funds. For example, North Dakota created their fund with the discovery of shale. Their fund was created 5 or 6 years ago now. It's about $6 billion in comparison to the $65 billion. And they started it similar to what APF did in that they could only invest in bonds originally as they were getting their toe wet with this. So they've expanded their asset allocation. They're trying to get into more of this, but it's definitely a learning curve.
One last question. We need to be competitive with not just the national but the global market for these types of investments. I suspect you wouldn't be here asking for this modification of the procurement rules without the belief that we were falling behind with the opportunity, and the cost for not doing this would be just the missed opportunity. Would that be correct?
Through the chair, that is correct.
Any further questions or discussion? I'm going to set this bill aside. We're going to bring it back to us today. There's just a few more questions I really need to be a little bit more comfortable with. I hear some on that, but we are going to be back anyway for, excuse me, for SB 16 as well. So if anyone has any other questions, please reach out to my office. We'll make sure that they get answered if we have any more on those. So at this time, I want to make my apologies to those who are currently online for SB 16. We will open public testimony once we have the committee substitute. And at this time, it's 3:18 p.m., and we're going to recess the call of the chair. I call the House Finance Committee back to order. Again, I'll go ahead. We have Representative Merrick, Representative Josephson, Representative Sullivan Leonard, Representative Ortiz, Representative Knopf, Representative Lebon, Representative Carpenter, Vice Chair Johnston, I'm Representative Wilson. Representative Foster is still working on the operating budget. I have Representative Tilton as well. Sorry for the in and out today. What we're going to do now is we are going to go over the CS for Senate Bill 16. What I'm going to do is I'm going to go through the bill. What I've done is brought this back to grandfathering in the fair, which is where we started at. When this bill first came, it kind of grew a lot of legs along the way, and we have brought it simple. I'm not going to take any questions from the committee right now because we're going to go to public testimony, but there will be opportunity when we have that before us. So before we begin, we're going to go to Representative Johnston. Yeah, now.
Yes. Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. I move HB 139-31-LS0834-A from committee with individual recommendations and fiscal notes.
Sorry, that's object for a moment. I skipped that part of it, and so we're going to back up here. I was going right into the other one, and we forgot to move a bill first. And it could be Representative Johnston's bill, so she might be a little bit more in a hurry of getting that done. So, first of all, we heard earlier, HB 139, Alaska Permanent Fund Corporation Procurement Exemption. Any more discussion on HB 139? Seeing and hearing none, Representative Johnston.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Madam Co-Chair, I move HB 139-31-LS0834-A from committee with individual recommendations and fiscal notes.
Hearing and seeing no objection, HB 139 will move from the House Finance Committee. And with that, Representative Johnston.
Yes, Madam Co-Chair. I move the committee adopt CSSB 1631-LS0283-C as the working document.
Object for purposes of discussion and to hear the differences.
Thank you, Representative Johnston. Sure. Josephson.
Sure.
And again, my intent is if we're going to go over the sectional, then we have several people online. What I will do too, again, we will leave public comment open because we had others who had signed in, and because we didn't have the CS yet, I just want to make sure everybody has the opportunity to weigh in. So you should have the CS for Senate Bill 16 in front of you. Section 1 amends AS04-11080. Types of licenses and permits to add a fair license and performing arts license to the list. Section 2, as a new section, AS04-11205, performing arts theater license, $1,250 biennial fee. The section defines this type of license. There is a theater license in regulation currently. This just moves it into statute. Section 3, as a new section to AS04-11210D, to grandfather in previously licensed entities under the recreation site license if they were valid on December 31st, 2018. This applies to businesses that were operating in accordance to the terms of their license but were determined by the ABC board to not meet the statutory definition of recreational site licensing. Section 4, as a new section, fair license. This section defines this type of license. The biennial fee for the license is $800. Section 5 amends AS04-11330D to require a performing arts theater and recreation site license to use their license at least once in the previous two calendar years in order for renewal. Section 6. It's the current language that we already have in existence about a person under 21 years of age may not knowingly enter or remain in premises licensed under this title unless accompanied by a parent. The person is at least 16 years of age, and if they're under 16 years of age, they are accompanied by a person over 21 years of age. The person is permitted on the premises under a club license issued under AS04-11G or otherwise provided under C, D, or G, or I of this section. Section 7 adds provision for conditions upon which minors can be on a licensed premise, and specifically a performing arts theater, to mirror language when minors can be on a golf course with alcohol service. Section 8 amends ASO 421065A to add the new licenses to the list of those required to post notice on the designated premise. Sections 9 through 11 amend AS 4360040, Administration Enforcement of Tax, to provide an incentive for filing timely monthly tax returns and paying taxes on time over the most recent 3 years. Specifically, it removes the $25,000 surety bond requirement if all other requirements of compliance are met. Also, as an effective date, sections including the retroactivity to accommodate the transition language. That is what this current CS does. And with that, we're going to go right into public testimony. Again, we will have this bill for questions and discussion tomorrow morning at 9 a.m., as well as if individuals were not able to testify today, they will have another opportunity in the morning. So our first individual is Chris Mayer from the Alaska Travel Adventures here in Juneau. Thank you for being back with us again this afternoon. If you could please put yourself on the record and your affiliation, you may begin your testimony.
Hi, thank you, Madam Chair. Good afternoon. I'm Chris Mayer. I'm the president of Alaska Travel Adventures. And I'd just like to talk briefly about Senate Bill 16. So Senate Bill, first a little background real quick about our company. We've been in business here for 40 years, and we've operated the Gold Creek Salmon Bake as one of our businesses. And in that 40-year history, we have served alcohol, beer and wine. We've had a beer and wine license under the recreational site license. And that allowed us to also play music for our guests. And 3 years ago, when these licenses really started to come under scrutiny, we were put on notice that we were going to lose our license, our recreational site license, because it didn't meet the statute. And so we aggressively went out and we're looking for licenses to purchase, because we are a restaurant. We're a bona fide restaurant also, including and plus a recreational site. It's an outdoor salmon bake with hiking trails, and we have gold panning there and campfires, and it's an entire experience. But at any rate, we were able to, a year ago, find the only available restaurant license for purchase. And knowing that we were going to lose this recreational site license, we went out and purchased that license. I'll mention also, we've lost one other recreational site license associated with our river rafting business that we held for several years. And we're in danger of losing another recreational site license we have in Skagway. We've been put on notice by AMCO that we'll lose that license upon renewal attempt in 2 years. So, sorry, this is a little bit confusing, but back to the issue here in Juneau at the Salmon Bake. We were able to secure that restaurant eating place license. We just finally got that approved and started this year utilizing that license. Part of that process is that I had to surrender our recreational site license. So that license, unfortunately, was surrendered in order to obtain this new license. You can't hold two licenses for one establishment at the same time, apparently. So in the last committee, in Labor and Commerce, there was language in this bill that would have allowed us to both serve beer and wine, as well as play music. Right now, there's a limitation on music hours from 3 p.m. to 11 p.m. The language that was in the prior version of this bill would have allowed music to be played from 11 a.m. until 7 p.m. And that would have gotten us our lunch guests, because 3 p.m., obviously, we miss all of our lunch guests. We couldn't play music for them. So 11 to 7 was really close. I was hopeful to come in today and ask for 11 to 8, but I see now that it's been removed. That language is no longer in this version of the bill, in this CS. So as of right now, the business model that we've used successfully has been taken away. We cannot play music until 3 p.m., which costs us all of our lunch business. So I guess I'm a little bit at a loss of what to do here. What I would really like to see is the language that was in the prior. Okay. The language that was in the prior bill, which allowed us to start at 11 a.m., would have allowed us to start at 11 a.m. and go to 7. That would be preferable. But I'm just reading through this in the brief time that I've had, another potential solution, if this bill were to move forward, could possibly be if the language were to state that licenses that were active on the 31st of last year, recreational site license on the grandfathering part, licenses that were active or had been surrendered in that calendar year, because then I could go back, I think, to AMCO and try and get my old license back that I had to surrender in order to get the new license.
And if I understand you correctly, that if you were able to get that license back, that would give you the opportunity to do the music portion that you're talking about. Is that correct?
Correct. Yes. Yes. I could continue to operate our business the way we have for 40 years successfully. Yes.
And I appreciate that, because my intent of rolling this back was to keep those things that were legal at that time. I was not aware that others had surrendered licenses during that period of time. So I appreciate that. Are there any other questions? We will work on that. Thank you. Representative Barrick, did you have anything to add?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just quick, what are the hours that the Salmon Bake operates?
Well, you know, our first arrivals could, well, now with some of the earlier ships, could be as early as 10:30 in the morning. And then we have guests arriving until usually about 7:30 at night. All of our guests are usually out of there by about 9:30 at the latest. So, you know, my original hope was that we would be able to do like 11 a.m. to 11 p.m., and that would encompass 100% of our customers that have historically had the experience. But anyways, yeah, short answer is 10:30 to about 9:30 at night, 10:30 in the morning, 9:30 at night.
Thank you.
But it sounds like the best way that we might be able to amend this is something that I was not aware of, that the individual companies that actually surrendered the licensing during this period of time while they were trying to be legal in the new era. So I appreciate that, and we will take that up.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Any other questions? Seeing none, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Next we have Robert Brewster. Please put yourself on the record and your affiliation, please.
Thank you, Chair Wilson and members of the House Finance Committee, for the opportunity to testify on Senate Bill 16 today. My name is Robert Brewster, and I'm the CEO of the Alaska Club. I want to advocate for passage of SB 16. We've been recreational site license holders in our 21 and over Summit location for 8 years. During that time, we've never been cited for any violation, and we've complied with all the applicable regulations and fees. In the process of building our club and business model, we worked with a staff member of the Alcohol Beverage Control Board to identify an appropriate license and complete the application process. We were issued a recreational site license and relied on that qualification to construct our premises, define our product, and make representations that beer and wine would be available to our clients. As many people are aware, efforts by the ABC to restrict this license time have been underway for several years. In fact, approximately 2 years ago, ABC personnel showed up at our business without notice or violation to terminate our license. We were forced to stop serving for 11 months while we appealed the issue. Eventually, an administrative judge ruled in our favor, returning our license. Among the problems that she cited were her opinion that our constitutional rights to equal protection had been violated and that it was inappropriate for our license to be terminated pending the appeal process. Our license was returned, and we've continued to operate in a responsible manner. At no point were we warned that this would be our final renewal. Earlier this year, we were once again denied a renewal of that license. We find ourselves caught in the middle of the entire recreational site license issue, and we are being significantly damaged due to no fault of our own. We are not alone, and many responsible operators who are similarly situated are being subjected in some cases to devastating results due to this change in licensing. I know that the ABC has a difficult job to do managing liquor consumption around the state, and we acknowledge that the current parameters of the recreational site license are less than clear. But we, along with others, applied in good faith, received our licenses, invested in the business, operated responsibly, and represented to our customers that this would be part of their experience. Now, denied businesses will be significantly impaired or put out of business entirely. Please help to correct this unfortunate outcome of the non-renewals, which serve no valid public purpose and, in fact, are doing unfortunate harm to responsible businesses. I respectfully ask that you pass SB 16 as written and provide a framework to correct the current unfair and detrimental circumstances of recreational site licensees who have been operating responsibly under the current license classification. Thank you again for the opportunity to testify on this issue today.
So, Mr. Brewster, I know you probably haven't had a chance to see the CS, but if we're grandfathering in all those under recreational licensing, that will take care of your issue?
I believe they will, yes.
Perfect. Thank you. Any other questions? Okay. Thank you very much for being online. Is there anyone else in the room who'd like to testify today? Seeing none, I don't have any others online. Again, we will hold public testimony open for our 9 a.m. meeting tomorrow. Also, we'll give others opportunity to look at the CS. From within that, we have been in contact with the alcohol on board as well. Are there any questions or other discussion on the new CS that is before us? Representative Knopp.
For you, Madam Chair. I just look at the language that the gentleman pointed out, and I haven't had time to go through the entire bill, but it used to be an old language that said you could have entertainment from 3 to 11 p.m. Is that actually eliminated in the new committee substitute, do you know, or does that language still exist in this one?
Representative Knopp, that would still exist. Our issue, I think, right now from the gentleman we heard is that we only took into account active licensing at a certain point. I was unaware that individuals had surrendered their licensing, going in for another one. It is my understanding we will check with Ms. McConnell as well, who is not online right now, to make sure that but from my understanding, and I see a lot of nodding in the audience, that as long as we made sure that we put the surrender part in there and they would be able to get that back, and we would probably have to work out the whole issue of them having another one and where that goes, but that would allow them to do all the activities they were doing prior. The way this bill would also work is that if someone had a performing arts, for instance, and they sold the business, as long as it was still performing arts, it would go with the activity that it is. But if it stopped being that activity, that's how basically these licenses would at some point would go away if those activities quit. But to me, from everything I've been able to understand, everyone was doing the things that they were supposed to do under what they believed to be legal, and then there was a reinterpretation of this by the ABC board, and that's kind of where we got where we are. Representative Knopp.
So I want to check with you, see what the amendment process is, but I'd like to, I don't see that 3 to 11 in here. I'd like to see it go 11 to 11 if I have a voice in the amendment process. And the reason I say that is because the current language in the old one says 11 a.m. to 7 p.m. or 3 to 11, which really makes no sense to me. It should just go 11 to 11, and they will provide that entertainment during their lunch crowds or their dinner crowds, but as you know, midday typically falls off. So I just want to make sure, see if we can get something like that back in the
right. We also have staff from Senator Michiki's office, too. If you'd like to weigh in, that is fine. If I understand you correctly, Representative Knopp, you'd like to have 11 a.m. to 11 p.m. Do I hear Ernesto play music, correct?
That's correct.
And also we what I'd like to be able to fix this is within this is if you surrendered and you were up to date at that time to reach out in that. We don't normally do things in the process, in this kind of process, but we're at the end of the session. So I want to make sure that if there's anything else that we need to look at, we do it immediately. Representative Merrick.
Just a friendly, not amendment to the amendment, but Mr. Myers said that the salmon bake ends at 9:30 p.m. And I was just curious if it is in a location where there's residential area next to it where playing music till 11 p.m. might be a disturbance? You know, is cutting that time off at 9:30 appropriate, or is it somewhere that won't bother anybody residentially?
Could you please put yourself back on the record, and you can answer Representative Merrick's question?
Yeah, for the record, Chris Meyer with Alaska Travel Adventures, Madam Chair. Yeah, we, like I said, we've been doing this for 40 years, 25 years at the current site without any issue whatsoever. And, you know, this is an issue that we've discussed a little bit going through this process this year. And, you know, the reality is I believe there's noise ordinances that regulate that concern. So, and like I say, we've never had a complaint.
Fantastic. Yeah. Thank you. So I'll make sure we didn't cause any problems that take us a step backwards. So fantastic.
Yeah, and city ordinances would trump state statute.
Thank you.
As long as they're more restrictive.
Thanks.
Yeah.
Okay. Any other questions or any other issues that someone would like to bring? Oh, sorry, Representative Ortiz.
So, Madam Chair, just so I'm clear as to the process, and certainly have the understanding that we're operating in, under tight time frames, if there's another suggested change that we make to this current CS, do we do that through your office or do we do that through the amendment process, and when would that amendment process take place?
Okay, I would like to, I cannot tell you what to do, although I might want to, but the intent really is we could do the amendment process and we'd have amendments by the morning. If you know something tonight, I'd like to get those corrected from within. My intent with this bill is to try to keep it as clean as possible. The bill came before us to take care of the issue with these recreational licensing, kind of like what did we had the Roadhouse bill last year where someone was doing things for a long time and then found out that it wasn't quite the way it was supposed to at the beginning on that. So what I would hope we would not do is start adding new licenses. The only new one in here is a fair one, only because if someone doesn't want to just be grandfathered in but they want to have a true license, they don't have to worry about things changing, it would give our fairs that opportunity. They could stay underneath the recreational licensing if they want to. But beyond that, I would hope that we wouldn't be putting a whole lot of other events from within. But again, it will be if you can find six votes. But I think the cleaner we can keep it and solve the problem that came before us, I think that there were a lot of things in the bill that I think are good ideas. They just, in my opinion, needed more than 24 hours to vet, which is pretty much the time we have to be able to get back to the other body. So, hearing no others, is there anything else to come before us? Our next meeting will be at 9 a.m. where we will have this bill and public testimony before us, and we will also have one other bill. So hearing and seeing none, it is 4:34, and we are adjourned.